Shrink Wrap Radio number 428, a report from the sexual frontier with sex therapist Dr. Marty Klein.
It's Shrink Wrap Radio. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make it dangerous. It's all in your head. And now here's your host, Dr. Dave.
My guest today is Marty Klein, PhD, who has been a licensed marriage and family therapist and certified sex therapist for 31 years. He's the author of 6 books, and he says he has aimed his entire career toward a single set of goals: telling the truth about sexuality, helping people feel sexually adequate and powerful, and supporting the healthy sexual expression and exploration of women and men. For more information about Dr. Marty Klein, please see our show notes for this episode at shrinkwrapradio.com. Now, here's the interview. Dr. Marty Klein, welcome to Shrink Wrap Radio.
Great to be here, David. Thank you.
Well, it's good to have you on the show. Our mutual friend, Ofer Zur, who also hosts my continuing ed courses, has repeatedly said, you have to have Marty on your show. So I'm glad that's finally come about.
Thank you.
So, of course, your specialty is sex therapy. And so I want to ask, how did a nice boy like you get involved in sex therapy?
Well, as you know, I've been a sex therapist and licensed marriage and family therapist for 35 years. The way I got started, David, is when I was out of graduate school, I wanted a career in social change, and I decided that I wanted to get involved with family planning as a way of reducing poverty and domestic violence.
Uh-huh.
So I was involved with family planning for a while, and what I realized was that there's a step before getting people to use contraceptive technology, and that is they need to be comfortable with their sexuality. So you can throw as many diaphragms as you want at people, but if they're not comfortable putting their fingers inside their vaginas, if they're not comfortable saying to a partner, I'd like to use birth control, if they're afraid that their boyfriend is going to think they're a slut or whatever, that's going to undermine dramatically contraceptive use. So I got into sexuality as a way of facilitating family planning. And then once I was in sexuality, I saw that there's a lot of other things going on besides family planning. And so I came for the birth control, but I stayed for the sex. What can I say?
That's a good line. So you talked about being interested in change, and I'm wondering, what sorts of changes in the field have you witnessed over the course of the 35-year career so far?
Well, there's a lot more acknowledgement of the broad range of sexual expression that people have. When I was first starting in the field back in the late 70s, there was very little conversation about S&M, very little conversation about bisexuality, very little conversation about fetishes and paraphilias, very little conversation about consensual non-monogamy. So over the course of the last 30, 35 years, there's been a much broader view of the way that people are involved in sexuality, and that's a good thing.
Yeah, okay. And, you know, sexuality is such a hot topic that I'm wondering if there are major controversies within the field. Are there issues that are hotly debated at this point in time?
Oh, sure. Well, there's a controversy about whether or not sex addiction is the best way to describe some people's problematic behavior and decision making. In fact, if you go to Wikipedia and you look up sex addiction, I'm the person they cite as being a good example of someone who believes that the whole concept of sex addiction is not very helpful. So that's one controversy.
Okay.
And actually, it's not so much a controversy in sex therapy. It's a controversy everywhere else. Most people in the sex therapy field at this point don't think that sex addiction or porn addiction are clinically helpful concepts. But everybody else seems to think that there's a controversy about that. And another controversy is about pornography in general. Is it undermining people's ability to engage in or to create productive sexual relationships with real people? And to what extent does it lead to sexual violence and all of that? The data on that is very, very, very clear that people who look at a lot of pornography are no more likely to engage in violent or coercive behavior than anybody else. But that's something that we're always talking about, pornography.
Yeah, we'll come back to that and explore that some more. Go ahead.
Okay. And, you know, there's always conversation about compare and contrast heterosexual male sexuality to heterosexual female sexuality. That's something that I think people will never get tired of talking about. And we're talking about it now. We talked about it 35 years ago. We talked about it 100 years ago. That's something that never goes out of style, talking about that. And now, of course, there's a lot of conversations about consent, whether it's the new regulations on college campuses or the new video that you may have seen about catcalling, or in California, there's a new law that it's not just that no means no, it's that yes has to mean yes. So the whole concept of consent and who is allowed to consent and what does consent look like, that's something that that we're talking a lot about lately.
Yeah, that's an interesting one. I didn't have that on my list, so maybe we can go into that one a bit. And also, I'm wondering, what about and I'm not sure what to call this, but sort of false memory syndrome, if you will, where people remember or supposedly buried memories are right. Uncovered of sexual right. Abuse.
Well, the whole issue of sexual exploitation is very complicated and very interesting. There was a time when there were a whole lot of people who were claiming that lots more people had been sexually exploited as children than anyone ever suspected. And in fact, there were people back in the 80s and 90s who were saying that if you don't remember whether or not you'd been sexually exploited, that proved that you had been, which is kind of a crazy idea. And it led to a lot of terrible, terrible court cases where people were dragged into court on the most bizarre charges of sexual exploitation, and almost everyone in the sex field knows somebody who was dragged into court or thrown into jail. I don't think at this point there's much question that most people, if they suffer trauma, the problem is not that they forget. The problem is that they can't forget. The problem yeah. is that they keep remembering. And so hopefully this whole idea of if you go to the right therapist can help you drag up memories that you didn't have about sexual abuse. Hopefully that's over with. But there are still people who feel that if there's any ambiguity in a person's biography, if there's any ambiguity in a person's memory, they should assume that they've been sexually abused, which is a terrible, terrible, terrible idea, and really, really not helpful for people at all.
Well, let me ask you, why is it such a terrible idea?
Well, first of all, it's a terrible idea because it's simply not true. But it's a terrible idea because, you know, historically, people have believed that memory is like videotape, that you have an experience and your brain codes that as if it were a video camera, and it records everything accurately, and that as long as you don't have a memory disorder like, say, Alzheimer's or some kind of dementia, the idea was that you could go back and access that videotape. So it would be like, recording the Super Bowl 5 years ago. it would be recorded perfectly. And then today you would pop that tape into your VCR if you still had a VCR, or if you would look at that recording and you would see the Super Bowl recorded exactly as it was, took place in real life 5 years ago. Well, human memory doesn't work like that. Human memory is much more complicated. We don't record things necessarily accurately. In many cases, we record things metaphorically. We record the emotional truth of situations more than we record the literal truth of situations. So that's the first issue. And then the second issue is that when people recall things, we typically recall things not through the eyes that we had back then. We typically recall things through the eyes that we have now. Mm-hmm. So, when I think about something that happened in my first marriage, I may remember the events, but I'm looking at those events through my eyes now as a more sophisticated person, as whether I'm more apologetic or I'm more insightful, or I have a more of a sense of fair play, or more of a sense of self-respect, or whatever it is. So relying on memory, relying on what people say when they're 40 about what happened to them when they were 7 is very, very complicated. And it is not nearly so simple as, well, let's just pop the recording in the machine and let's just look at what happened when you were 7. It's not nearly so simple as that.
Yeah, I've experienced that myself in my marriage and with friends when we compare memories from some time back. And the stories that we have are so different.
Yeah, yeah.
About supposedly objective events.
Yeah, and that's the rule rather than the exception. And yeah. And the last thing I want to say about this is that there are lots and lots of experiences that children have around sexuality that don't hurt them and don't really make them think twice until some grown-up tells them, oh, my God, you've had this horrible thing happen to you. Or until some therapist tells them when they're 46 years old, oh, my God, you had this terrible thing happen to you. So I've had patients come to me who have said things like, well, my last therapist told me that since when I was a child and I would sit on my uncle's lap and then there was a wet spot on my uncle's pants after I got up, that proved that I was molested. So we really have to be very, very careful about interpreting children's experiences for them, either when they're children or when they're adults. And that's not to say that we don't want to protect children. Of course we want to protect children. We want to move heaven and earth to protect children. But we don't want to impose our adult categories on childhood experience, particularly around sexuality, and attempt to convince them that they've been harmed when they themselves don't experience harm. We want to be very slow to do that.
Yeah, and that's going to come up again later in our discussion here in a slightly different guise. You mentioned your practice. What can you tell us about your work as a sex therapist in terms of the kinds of problems you tend to see these days and how you approach them?
Well, most of the problems are the same old problems. Guys who ejaculate more quickly than they want to, guys who don't get erect when they want to, women who don't have orgasms when they want to, and then, of course, the biggest problem that people come into sex therapy with, which is desire issues. They don't desire their partner the way that they want to, where their partner doesn't desire them the way that they want them to. And then there are some new problems having to do with the internet or with pornography or people who are watching porn way more than is helpful, or people who are involved in cyber sex and it's interfering with the rest of their lives. So I do pretty much all kinds of stuff relating to sexuality, and I'm also a licensed marriage and family therapist. So about half of my caseload is about sexuality, and the other half of my caseload is sort of general psychotherapy and couples counseling.
Well, you cited quite a range of problems there. Is there
we are a full service shop over here.
Yeah. Is there a particular theoretical model that you subscribe to, or kind of a general characterization that you could give of your approach in dealing with the sexual issues specifically?
Well, you know, the simple answer is not really. Although when I teach, people come up to me and they say, "Oh, I can see that you use a such and such approach," and I've never had any training in such and such approach. But you know, after 35 years, basically I do whatever seems to work as long as it's ethical, and I do a little bit of object relations work and a little bit of Gestalt and a little bit of trance work and a little bit of narrative therapy, a little bit of existential therapy. It really depends on the patient. You know, what some people have is a functional problem. You know, there's something wrong with their body. What some people have is there's something wrong with their relationship. What some people have is they have a spiritual yearning. What some people have is they have an existential problem. So, I try and listen real carefully and then meet people where they are and then provide them with a relationship in which they can bang around and figure out what they need to figure out.
Good answer. I can get on board with that. I see on your website that you've also done forensic work. What can you tell us about that?
It's very hard. It's very hard work. I do a lot of expert witnessing, and whenever I'm on the stand, I have to remind myself I'm not the one who's in trouble. Because it's
they can
it's
come very, after you, huh?
Yeah, it's very scary. The forensic work that I do, I mean, there's an enormous number of laws that regulate our sexual behavior. There are more laws today regulating our sexual behavior than there were the day that I got licensed in 1980. And some of those laws have to do with the internet, some don't. But there are laws, for example, about regulating age play on the internet. You know, going into an adult chat room and pretending to be a teenager. There are laws that regulate that, and there are lots of people who are in jail right now because they went into an adult chat room and they said, "Hey, is there anybody here who wants to chat?" And some other adult speaks up and says, "Oh, I'm Mary Jane, and I'm just home from school. I would love to chat with you." And then it turns out, so you know, this person talks with somebody they assume is an adult pretending to be a teenager, and it turns out it's a cop pretending to be a teenager, and then the person gets arrested for having inappropriate sexual conversations with a minor, which is against the law. And when a person says, well, really, I really thought it was an adult pretending to be a teenager, the answer is typically, we don't believe you. We think that you thought this was a real teenager, and so you're going to jail for 100 years, which makes it a thought crime. And it's terribly upsetting. So I sometimes am asked to be an expert witness in cases like that. There's laws regulating sexting, and so sometimes teenagers send nude photos of themselves to their pals, and then that gets out of hand, and then the police swoop in and they decide, or the prosecutor swoops in and decides that a 16-year-old sending a nude photo of herself to her boyfriend is actually engaged in creating and distributing child pornography, which is kind of bizarre that laws that are designed to protect children are used to harm children. So I do a variety of things. I just did a case in a South African court about whether or not they were deciding whether or not to allow the Playboy Channel to stay on South African television. And they asked me for my expert opinion on does pornography cause people to be violent? So it's a wide range of stuff, all in the arena of sexuality, and it's fascinating work. I learn a lot doing it, and I sometimes actually get to be helpful to somebody, which is very gratifying. But the whole thing is very scary. The court system is very scary. I mean, we have a system that's an adversarial system. So there's nothing quite like sitting in a little chair in a room full of strangers where somebody who is skillful and trained is trying to make you look like a moron. There is nothing like that experience, David.
Yeah, I read a transcript once. I think it was either when I was in graduate school or right after. It was a transcript of a psychologist on the stand, and the prosecutor just made him look so bad that it struck fear to my core. ever since. So I applaud your courage. And it does sound exciting. Now, you even wrote a book called America's War on Sex, The Attack on Law, Lust, and Liberty.
Yes.
Is there anything more that you want to say about that book? I imagine it covers some of what you've just said. But
well, the book is about 8 or 9 battlegrounds in the United States that are the focus of the war on sex, and sex education, reproductive rights, sexual minorities, the internet, stuff like that.
Yeah.
And the book lays out this highly focused, well-funded, very skillful attack on our rights in all these various arenas. And when I wrote the book, most, although not all, most of those attacks were coming from the religious right, and they were very effective, and they've really changed the landscape of how we walk through the day, whether we know it or not. These days, there are additional attacks coming from the left, which I find even more troubling in a way. People who are calling for limitation on our rights to speak freely on college campuses, or people who are calling for a limitation on our rights to say what we want to say on the internet, mm-hmm. or on the radio. It's very troubling when the answer to anything is we have to limit people's rights to say what they want to say.
Uh-huh.
So, there's a lot of those laws. I mean, the abortion issue in this country is the most extreme it's ever been since abortion was completely criminalized. The strategy now is in state after state after state to make legal abortion so difficult that people just throw up their hands and say never mind. So, for example, in some states, you have to wait 72 hours before you can get an abortion. And in some states, they don't even count weekends. So you could go in and, on a Thursday and say, I want an abortion. And they say, well, you have to wait 3 days. So that's Friday, Monday, Tuesday, come back Wednesday. And then so you have to go away and come back. And for low-income people, that's not a trivial thing. And in a lot of states, you know, the nearest abortion provider is like 200 miles away. So you have to take off a whole day of work, which for some people is just impossible. You have to take a whole day off of work twice, maybe more. And it's always interesting to me that you can get open heart surgery more easily than you can get an abortion in many, many places now, in many states. I mean, there's no mandatory waiting period if you want open heart surgery. You know, you walk in, you need it, you get it. And there's no mandatory script that doctors have to read about, well, open heart surgery may have the following consequences. But with abortion, there is. In most states now, in many states now, the doctor is forced to read a script that frequently is not medically accurate, by the way. It's just awful. So it's really amazing that in this day and age there are people who say I don't think I should have an abortion, and I am going to use the weight of the law to prevent you from having an abortion. Or for that matter, you know, I don't want to look at pornography, and I'm trying to use the weight of the law to prevent you from looking at pornography. Or I don't want to go to a strip club. I don't want my husband to go to a strip club, and I'm going to use the law to prevent you from going to a strip club. It's so un-American, you know. It's so against the traditional idea in America, which is that people should have the right to do what they want as long as it doesn't bother anybody else. But some people are claiming that your private sexuality is their public business. That's what I talk about in America's War on Sex, that the religious right has really succeeded in making our private sexual decisions a matter of public concern.
Mm-hmm.
And that's just dreadful.
Yeah. In our email exchange, you mentioned something about a new reporting law for psychotherapists. What's that?
Oh, yeah. Well, the state legislature just passed a new law, AB 1775, if you're keeping score at home. So historically, there are people in every state, there are people who are mandated to report child sexual abuse, psychologists, physicians, We are mandated to report certain things. We don't have any discretion about it. We are mandated. We are required by virtue of having a license that if we observe certain things, we have to report it to the police. Or if we're told certain things, you know, if you come into therapy, I say, well, everything you say here is confidential, except. So if you tell me that you are planning to hurt somebody else very badly, and I really believe you're going to do it, and you've talked about how you're going to do it and when you're going to do it and why you're going to do it, if I believe that, if I think you're telling me the truth rather than just a fantasy, I'm required by the state to report that. Nothing wrong with that. Well, I mean, it's complicated, but at the end of the day, I think, you know, everybody supports some version of that.
Yeah.
And one of the things that we're mandated to report is child sexual abuse. Okay, that makes sense. The law just changed to say that the definition of reporting child sexual abuse has expanded so that if you come into therapy and you say to a therapist, I have looked at sexual images of a child online once, I am now mandated to report that as an example of child sexual abuse. And there's so many things that are wrong with that on so many levels. I mean, for one thing, looking at a picture of a child is not the same thing as hurting a child. For another thing, most people who look at images, sexual images of children, they don't go on to actually touch children and hurt them. And for another thing,
So there's been research on that?
Oh, yeah, yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah. And in fact, in countries where the child porn laws change, where they either get less restrictive or more restrictive, the level of sexual exploitation of children changes with it. So it sounds counterintuitive, but the fact is, and this has been documented over and over, that when laws about child pornography get looser, the amount of child sexual abuse goes down, not up. Mickey Diamond at the University of Hawaii has looked at this, and this has been duplicated in Japan and Denmark and a couple of other countries. So,
it's got something to do with forbidden fruit, sounds like.
Well, I don't want to get into why I think that is, because that's a complicated conversation, mm-hmm. and I think the answer is different for different people. But you know, the whole issue of child sexual abuse is so radioactive that there's a lot of people who really don't want to look at the science of it. And there are a lot of assumptions that if a person looks at a picture of a minor, now remember, you know, minors, they could be 17 years old, right?
Yeah.
You know, from an evolutionary point of view, everyone is wired to look at 17-year-olds and think that they're sexually attractive.
Mm-hmm.
In the old days, we used to call those people wives. Now we call them children. So, and it's not so long ago. It's not so long ago. You know, 100 years ago, half of the marriages were to people who were 17 years old. Now it's among white middle-class people, of course, 17-year-olds don't get married anymore. The whole idea that looking at one image of a child being sexual turn somebody into a child molester, that's just not accurate. It's just not accurate. And it's so sad that we have so many laws designed to regulate our sexuality that are not based on science. They're not based on fact. They're based on fear. They're based on rumor. They're based on tradition. They're based on religious beliefs. That's just no way to run a country. But in the U.S., that's the way it is.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's go back to talking about pornography, which certainly what you've just been talking about certainly overlaps with. The Internet has fostered an explosion of porn that's readily and endlessly available. So from your point of view, what's been the impact of that, both in terms of the upside and the downside?
Well, we should start by remembering that there was a time in the world before the Internet. Believe it or not, yes, ladies and gentlemen, I'm so old, and I know, David, you are too. I'm so old that I remember before the Internet. Unbelievable. So before the Internet, there was pornography. Before the Internet, there was sexually acting out. Before the Internet, there was every kind of sexuality that there could possibly be. And the Internet has not changed that. What the Internet has changed is that there's tremendous access to sexual imagery of all kinds at your fingertips. You don't have to hide. You don't have to go to a theater downtown. You don't have to hide a magazine under your bed. You don't have to go and buy a magazine. The machine that you use for your work and for making your airline reservations and for looking up recipes for Thanksgiving turkey, that same machine now brings you unlimited sexual imagery. So the ecology of people using pornography has changed. There's less hiding and there's just less effort involved. There's less effort involved. It's just a lot easier. So that's one thing that has changed.
Well, does the fact that it is so abundantly and readily available, is there any evidence that that in some way blunts desire or blunts the ability to be responsive?
You know, there's no evidence for that. And as both a therapist and as a social theorist, what I think is that it's very hard to disentangle the effects of the internet from the effects of pornography. Because everybody who's looking at a lot of pornography is looking at the internet all the time. I mean, we're all looking at the internet all the time. But there are people who are really, I mean, I work in Silicon Valley. There are people who are on the internet basically from the time they wake up till the time they go to sleep. And I think that's having a big effect on people. When I go to a restaurant now and I see a couple, and each one of them is looking at their little iPhones instead of talking to each other.
Right.
I think that's a very serious phenomenon. When I go out in public and I see a group of four young people and they're all looking at their iPhones instead of talking to each other, I think this is a serious cultural phenomenon. That's not being talked about nearly enough. So what's happening, I think, is that, yeah, people are looking at pornography and they're getting unrealistic ideas about what men and women look like and what they do. But, you know, that was true before the internet. You know, when I was a kid, when I was 11 and 12 years old, I thought that people got pregnant from tongue kissing. You know, when I was 11 and 12 years old, I thought that you could measure how sexy, how much a girl wanted sex by how big her breasts were. So this was all in 1962. This was before the internet. So, and in 1962 and in 1972 before and 1982 before the internet, you know, young men were doing all kinds of crazy stuff in order to get sexual access to young women. They would lie to them. They would tell them stories. They would manipulate them. And young men had all kinds of sexual fantasies about young women. That's been going on since the beginning of time. So the whole idea that internet pornography is giving people, for the first time, these exclusively crazy ideas about sexuality, that's just factually wrong. What is true is that by the time people get to be 25 years old, they have fewer face-to-face experiences with dating than they used to. They have fewer examples of individual dating than they used to. Now it's more groups. And people are now running their relationships by text message or by email instead of face-to-face. And what that means is that people are not learning as much about the subtleties of communication. They're not learning how to read faces as well. They're not learning how to read tone of voice as well. They're not learning how to be sensitive to physical cues. And there's a lot of people who have an almost Asperger's or autistic approach to communication and relationships because they just don't have nearly as much experience as they used to. I think that's having a bigger impact on people's relationships today than how much pornography they are or aren't using.
Okay.
And I don't hear anybody talking about that.
Uh-huh.
Which is why you're nonplussed.
Well, I think people are talking about it. It seems to me that I have read editorials in various places and books and so on, where people are concerned about the about us being too buried in our technology.
But I don't hear that discussed as part of the pornography discussion.
Uh-huh.
When people say, for example, there are people who say, young men who look at porn, they have trouble getting it up with a real woman. Or young men who look at porn, they have trouble desiring real women. Now, first of all, I don't think that that's factually accurate. If you go to college campuses and you ask young men, most of whom are heterosexual, are you more interested in looking at porn or more interested in having sex with women? Almost all of them say, I'd much rather have sex with a woman than look at porn. So factually, I don't think that's correct. But what I don't hear talked about, when people say, young men are looking at porn and they have trouble getting it up. One of the reasons they have trouble getting it up, if they do, and I don't think they do, but one of the reasons is that they're just not used to talking to a woman face to face. They're just not used to calming themselves down and focusing on one thing at a time. Mm-hmm. So this whole idea that pornography is, I mean, here's another example. I hear that there's this big increase in young men saying to young women they want to have anal sex. Factually, that's accurate. There's a big increase in young men saying to young women, I want to have anal sex. And a lot of young women are feeling, quote unquote, pressured to do this. That is the exact same phenomenon as we saw 30 years ago when young men were saying to young women, ooh, there's this new thing called oral sex. I want you to go down on me. And women were feeling pressured to do that. And that's the same thing as 70 years ago when young men were saying to young women, I want to have intercourse, and women were feeling pressured to do that. So the I want this, oh, I feel pressured, I have to do this dynamic, that has not changed, and pornography has not changed that. The content being anal sex versus oral sex, from a structural point of view, that doesn't matter so much. What's interesting is that women are still having trouble saying no thank you, and people are still complaining that men are pressuring women rather than empowering women to say, I don't want to do it, and if I don't want to do it, I'm not going to do it, and if that's not good enough for you, take a hike, I'll find somebody else. So I think internet porn gets blamed for a lot of things where the blame should lie elsewhere.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's talk about sexting a bit, which is a variant on pornography.
Sure.
And I believe that you, like me, saw the November 2014 Atlantic Magazine article titled Why Kids Sext,
right,
by Hannah Rosen. And I also heard her interviewed on the radio and was able to find the article online. And I encourage our listeners to seek that article out because I thought it was very provocative and scary in a variety of ways. And for our listeners, let me provide a little background. Hannah Rosen is a journalist, not a psychologist. She conducted extensive in-person interviews with lots of sexting and non-sexting teens, judges, county prosecutors, and police in Louisa County, Virginia. She said the teens she interviewed came from a variety of racial and economic backgrounds, and she felt that what's going on there in that county is probably happening all around the country. And so I suspect this was a real eye-opener for most readers. So what was your reaction to this article?
Well, I thought it was good as far as it went, but it didn't go nearly far enough. She's shocked that so many young people are using their iPhones to facilitate their lives. There was nothing in it that was a surprise to me. Mm-hmm. Basically, it sounds that people are using sexting in the same way that they've used everything else in their adolescent lives. I think one of the more interesting things in the article, which is no big surprise if you think about it, but some people, once the subject is sex, people's eyeballs, sort of roll back in their heads and they can't think. She said,
particularly for parents. I don't know if you're a parent or not.
Particularly for parents. So, you know, a lot of young people say, well, you know, the reason I want a nude picture of that girl is because, you know, it proves that she likes me, or it proves that I'm persuasive, or it adds to my collection, or it gives me status. Not as some parents would assume, or some prosecutors would assume, that, oh, now that I have a nude picture of that girl, I'm going to masturbate to it, and I'm going to, you know, look at it and get excited and go rape somebody. So, you know, what she found was that a lot of the sexting that goes on is about power and status, not about sex, which makes perfect sense. It's the way that adolescents are, and frankly, it's the way that adults are. The thing that I've been saying about sexting since the very beginning of it is that we somehow expect that young people are going to use technology more in smarter ways than adults use it. We expect that kids are going to use cars smarter than adults use cars, and they don't. We expect that young people are going to use computers smarter than adults do, and they don't. We expect that young people are going to use their smartphones smarter than adults do, and they don't. And then adults get all hysterical about, I can't believe that young people use their cell phones in such stupid ways. Well, adults use them in stupid ways too. And the news is always filled with news about how adults are using their smartphones in stupid ways. Adults text while they drive. If there is a stupider activity, I guess a stupider activity than that would be getting drunk and then driving and texting while you drive, you know.
Yeah.
If there's a stupider activity than that, I can't think of it right now. Give me time, maybe I can. But I can't think of a stupider activity than driving and texting at the same time. Adults do that a lot. According to the Auto Club, more than a quarter of adults admit that they do that. So if you have 25% of adults using their cell phones in such unbelievably dangerous and damaging ways, why are we surprised if young people do that? We give young people the most powerful communications tool in the history of the human race. There's more computing power in a smartphone than there was at NASA when they put the first astronaut on the moon.
Yeah, I know. It's mind-blowing.
And we give that technology to 14-year-olds with virtually no instruction and no supervision. And then when they use those cell phones to do facilitate the two things that they're most interested in, which is communication and sex, parents are shocked and frightened.
Yeah. Some of the things that stood out for me in this article was, one, the prevalence of it, which evidently you're not shocked by, but that lots and lots of kids were doing this. Also, very interesting that for some portion of the guys, their motivation wasn't sexual so much as, you say, maybe relating to power, that is getting bragging rights, and they would develop a whole collection that they could share with their buddies.
Right.
But it wasn't particularly arousing. They said, no, if I want to get aroused, I'm going to go to the internet. They're a lot prettier there. And
right.
So I thought that was fascinating.
And this is totally predictable. It's totally predictable. But because the topic of the conversation is sexuality, adults stop thinking clearly, and they get surprised. But it's totally predictable.
Right. And she points that out, that that the people who are the law people, the prosecutors and the police, sometimes overreact, and that there are laws, in fact, that she points out that in many states, if not all of them, two 16-year-olds can have consensual sex, and there's no legal issue. But if they happen to send a nude picture of themselves to their partner, then they're in big trouble. It may even be a felony in that state.
Well, there are states in which it's a felony for a young person to take or distribute a photo of themselves, a sexual photo of themselves, even though it's legal for them to have actual sex, which is kind of crazy.
Yeah.
Which is kind of crazy. Yeah. Nebraska is one of them, right offhand. And there are people, there are young people in jail. There are young people who are registered sex offenders for life because they took a picture of themselves that they are not allowed to take. And I don't think young people really understand this. I don't think that young people understand that their bodies do not belong completely to them. You know, it's very counterintuitive, especially if we're doing a good job of explaining to young people, look, your body belongs to you, and if anybody wants to mess around with you, you say, no, this is my body, and you don't get access to it, which is, you know, a crucial message to give to young boys and young girls and adolescent boys and adolescent girls. It's crucial to remind them your body belongs to you, and nobody gets to have access to it without your permission. Then the state swoops in and says, well, but there are exceptions. You're not allowed to take pictures of yourself until you're 18. And it's completely counterintuitive. And there's something on my website. There's a little video on my website about me on some national TV show talking about age of consent. And the TV show talked to adolescents about age of consent, and most of them had no idea what was really involved. And the age of consent laws are problematic because, you know, 100 years ago, people got married when they were 15 and 16 and 17, and now people don't get married until they're 26 and 27, and the age of puberty has gone down, 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 down. So 100 years ago, the age of puberty was about 13 or 14. People got married when they were 15 or 16. There wasn't much of a lag there. But now the age of puberty is 10. People getting married when they're 26. That leaves a long period of time, whether it's the premarital sex zone or the non-marital sex zone, or people's bodies being sexually mature, but they don't have legal rights to use their sexual bodies. For young people, it's very confusing.
Yes, yes. And for parents, too, one of the things that I appreciated about the article was she seemed to be advocating a very nuanced approach to the context in which sexting was happening. So, for example, if it's two adolescents who are in love with each other and this is a way of expressing and sharing that love, that's one kind of situation. But she also describes situations in which young girls who lack self-confidence, don't have a very strong sense of their own identity and autonomy, may be pressured by boys to do things that then later are extremely humiliating for them when word gets out. And then, of course, then there is the whole issue of some of the sexting images going viral and actually being available to sexual predators. So
Hold it. I got to interrupt that. That's a really common thing that people say.
Uh-huh.
And show me 100 cases where that happened. Show me 100 cases where predators actually somehow got access to sexting photos and then went after the subject of the sexting. That just doesn't happen. That's not the way predators work. That's just not the way it works. But again, this is part of that moral panic. It's part of the, when the subject is sexuality, people have trouble thinking straight. It's very easy to say that this leads to that. It's, for example, it's very easy to say the fact that there are escorts in our community, that makes men think they can just go out and rape anybody on the street. I mean, that's just not the way it works in the real world. Yeah, there are predators out there. There are too many goddamn predators out there. But they have ways of doing things in the same way that everybody else has ways of doing things. You know, people
– sure.
People who are predators, they have established routines about how to find someone to do what they want to do. And getting a hold somehow or other of some teen's sex that goes viral and then they track that person down, that's just not the way it works. So,
okay, well, that's a good observation. Let's shift a bit to college kids and what's going on there. I had an undergraduate teaching assistant about 10 years ago who confided to me that he and other people he knew didn't date They don't date in the way that you and I probably dated growing up. They didn't go through the courtship rituals that we did when we were growing up. He said that they just go to a party, get wasted, and hook up. That is,
right.
Have a one-night stand.
Right.
Is that still the situation? Do you know how widespread
it's not even
is that?
It's not even a one-night stand. It's a one-hour stand.
Yeah, right. Wow.
I think the key thing in your description is they get wasted. The amount of alcohol being used now as part of the hookup culture is really the problem. The problem is not the hooking up. The problem is the alcohol. The mm-hmm. problem is the not being conscious during the selection of a sex partner and during the sex itself and what happens afterwards. And for those of our listeners who are of a certain age, you say, well, when I was in college, everybody was stoned. Actually, being stoned is different than being drunk. Being stoned is different than being drunk. That needs to be repeated by law enforcement and journalists and everybody else 1,000 times. Being stoned is different than being drunk. Now, having said that, more people are getting drunk now than were getting stoned back in the 60s and 70s. So there's this dramatic culture where people are deliberately getting drunk in order to have sex. And so what happens is that it's very difficult to negotiate a relationship properly. And when there is this hookup culture, when having sex is not the culmination of, I know you, I know you, I know you, I know you, let's have sex. Forget about love. I know you, I know you, I know you, I know you, let's have sex is different than, I don't know your name, let's get drunk and have sex. Or, I'm already drunk and I don't learn your name and let's have sex. People are simply not as skillful as interpreting each other's cues. People are not as skillful at evaluating risk and danger. People are not as skillful at saying, no, I really don't want to do this, or yes, I want to do this, although I don't want to do that. And people are not as skillful at saying, wait, I'm not done yet. People are not as skillful at saying, if I have sex with you, what's going to happen? Or if I have sex with you, will you phone me in the morning, right? You know, just all of that has been stripped away from young people, a lot of young people's sexual experience. And it's causing a tremendous mess. And I don't mind telling you that the new laws, the new federal directive on college campuses that colleges, you know, the directive is not colleges have to reduce the amount of sexual violence on campus. The directive is that more people have to get punished for sexual violence on campus. And those are two different things. But that federal directive that the Department of Education has given to college campuses now is resulting in, we're just seeing the beginning of a tidal wave of lawsuits and a tidal wave of young men, almost exclusively young men, who are being punished in he said, she said situations. And it's going to change the sexual scene on campus more than anything since the birth control pill of the 1960s.
Yeah, it's, I don't know, it seems like it's a very scary situation. There have been very high-profile stories about athletes in the news lately, and, I don't know the facts of those situations, because often they're happening, nobody knows.
Right.
It's the he said, she said, as you say.
But now there's a presumption that if A accuses B of sexual violence, B has to prove that it wasn't sexual violence instead of A having to prove that it was.
Yeah.
And that shift of blame is historic and it's tragic. You know, if A accuses B of murder, A has to prove that B did it on a college campus. A has to prove that B did it. But if A accuses B of rape, then A doesn't have to prove that B did it. B has to prove that they didn't do it. And with all this alcohol involved and with no witnesses, typically, it's very, very difficult for any of us to prove that any given sexual encounter was consensual. And Now there are these tribunals that are set up on college campuses where the person who's accused of rape doesn't get to have a lawyer who can speak for them, doesn't get to examine the documents, doesn't get to cross-examine witnesses, doesn't get to look at the charges as they were filed with the college. So if I were a young man on a college campus right now, I'd be terrified to have sex with anybody.
Mm.
And I'm a very friendly person.
And I'm confused by no means no and yes means yes. Can you say a little bit more about what the difference is there and why
there's one is? There's a big difference. There's a big difference. But, I mean, the real issue here is that sex, by its nature, is ambiguous. And sometimes when people say no, what they mean is, I'm not sure myself. Sometimes when people say yes, they're saying, well, yeah, I suppose I will, although I'd rather not. So it's not as clear-cut as no means no, yes means yes. I'm totally against coercion of any kind. I'm totally against people using sex to exercise power over each other or to hurt each other. I'm totally against that. But we need a lot more understanding of the ways in which people negotiate sexual encounters rather than just assuming that people are robots and that if we took a movie, if we took a movie of a sexual encounter, that every single person watching that movie could agree on, was this consent, was this not consent, was this pressure, was this coercion. It's a lot more complicated than that. And that's why artists and poets and musicians have been writing about this stuff for thousands of years, because it is so subtle and it is so complex. And I'm distressed when young women and young men want to rely on the law instead of learning how to take care of themselves better, assessing, what do I need to do to take care of myself? What do I need to do to ensure that I have a good experience? And what kinds of communication skills do I need if I'm going to harness this huge, powerful engine of my sexuality so that I get pleasure and satisfaction from it rather than danger?
And it is a huge, powerful engine, because we see adults in high places taking incredible risks with
absolutely
their careers, you know, that just
absolutely
end up bringing them down like in a Greek tragedy or something.
Absolutely. And again, we're expecting that young people are going to be able to run their sex lives in a smarter way than adults run theirs. And I don't know about you, David, but I make a living as a sex therapist working with adults who are not doing such a good job of running their sex lives. Mm-hmm. And that's a perfectly good segue to my current book, which is Sexual Intelligence,
okay,
What We Really Want from Sex and How to Get It. In that book, I talk a lot about this stuff. It's also available as a DVD series, Secrets of Sexual Intelligence. I'm sure you would like me to tell our listeners about my website, www.sexed.org. SEXED.org. There's articles there and there's a Q&A. I have my weekly blog about sexual issues, and there's a nice little store where I have DVDs and books. I've written 7 books about sex. That's how Ofer knows me, actually. So I want to give our listeners a discount code.
Oh, great. That
for the next 30 days, anybody who goes to my website at sexed.org and wants to buy something, you can get a 10% discount. All you have to do is use the discount code 10P, P as in Peter, and you get 10% off your total order.
Well, that's great. I'm sure people are going to be very glad to hear that. And Marty Klein, I want to thank you for being my guest on Shrink Wrap Radio.
Well, thank you. It's been a great pleasure.
I do hope that you enjoyed this discussion with today's guest, sex therapist Dr. Marty Klein. I find I'm still concerned about the issues raised by that Atlantic Magazine article I mentioned in my conversation with Dr. Klein. Once again, the title of the article is Why Kids Sext, and it's by Hannah Rosen. I was able to find it using Google and entering in the title and the author's name. I'll go a step further, though, and put a link to it in the show notes on our website. Dr. Klein sees online pornography and sexting as following an arc from previous examples of adolescent sexual curiosity in past decades. I agree about the arc, but do have concerns as to where that arc is leading. Is it a good arc, or one that's leading our culture in a negative direction? Personally, I have difficulty framing it as business as usual. I think both Dr. Klein and the author Hannah Rosen make sense when they point out that in many cases, these behaviors don't become upsetting to teens until the adults around them become hysterically upset and overreactive. Hannah Rosen really cautions parents to have conversations with their sexting children to better understand the context in which they are doing it and what it means to them, instead of going straight to alarm and blame. But I have to say I'm glad my kids are grown up. I think the issues for concerned, protective parenting are extremely complex now, much more so than when my wife and I were parenting. And it was difficult enough then. But I do have three beautiful, innocent, and still very young granddaughters, and it's hard for me not to have a heavy heart about this brave new world they'll soon be facing. It's one thing to think about it being somebody else's kids or grandchildren, but I shudder to look ahead. As Hannah Rosen says in her article, I think most parents would be shocked to know how prevalent sexting is. She goes on to say about the collections of Instagram sects that some boys collected, the girls on one Instagram page came from all across the board, she says. Every race, religion, social, and financial status in the town. If she was a teenager with a phone, she was on there. Rosen suggested in many cases parents should regard their daughter's sexting as a normal part of adolescent sexual exploration, while also warning that there are other circumstances where it clearly may be a sign of impending danger. Am I overreacting? I'd love to hear from you listeners on this topic.
Hi, Dr. Dave. This is Nikki Amaria Sargent, and I wanted to say thank you. I want to say I was a therapist in a clinical practice in a rural community that for many years, and it didn't have, still doesn't have, much in the way of public mental health resources, let alone training opportunities for its therapists. My personal journey led me into analysis and then analytic training and finally to be a certified union analyst. My rural colleague supported me in all of this despite questioning the relevance and the value of what I was doing. I still live in that country or community, though I practice in Palo Alto. Your podcasts have helped me learn the fields of study and persons of amazingly rich research and competence I know I have enjoyed greatly. I've told my rural cohorts about your interviews. This has helped them grow as clinicians, better serve their patients, understand me, and get CEU units without extensive driving and big carbon footprints. I'm so grateful for all your time and efforts to put together quality programming, bringing the treasures of depth psychology into contemporary discussion, and helping weave together communities of kindred spirits. Thank you, Dr. Dave.
Thank you, Nikki. I sure hope others will be inspired by your own generosity and kind words. We have only one new donation since the last podcast, and actually not so new, but listener Alan Tabor has doubled his monthly donation in exchange for my creating a compilation of 5 or 6 interviews only, on the topic of positive psychology and resilience. So I'll be sending him an MP3 file with a collection of my favorite interviews on those topics. He'll then give this compilation as a Christmas gift to friends and family who will appreciate it. I think this is a terrific idea, and I would be happy to create similar gift collections of interviews that you either specify or that I curate, and you also could give them as a unique gift during this holiday season. All that I ask is that you offer me some reasonable financial incentive, and I'll do the heavy lifting. So let me know if this idea appeals to you. And thanks again, Alan Tabor. Speaking of the gift-giving season, you know there's an Amazon widget in the right-hand sidebar that you can use to order not only any books you wish, but anything sold on Amazon. I know many of you probably use Amazon regularly to purchase all sorts of things. If you'll use the search tool in our widget, it will automatically add our affiliate code and shrink wrap will get a small percentage of the purchase. It's another way you can help to support the show that you love. We do have one new transcript on the site, thanks to my depth psychology intern, Eric Hanley. It's number 412, Meister Eckhart, Mystic Warrior for Our Time, with Matthew Fox. Thank you, Eric. Finally, I've got the perfect audiobook recommendation for you. It's a perfect companion piece to today's show. It's the book Sexual Intelligence, What We Really Want from Sex and How to Get It, by today's guest, Dr. Marty Klein. It's 7.5 hours of authoritative and entertaining information. Why read when you can listen? If you're not already an Audible subscriber, this audiobook can be yours free with no obligation to continue your subscription. Just go to audibletrial.com/shrink. And that's all there is to it.
Hi, this is Dr. Gabor Mate, and you're on the couch with Dr. Dave.
Thank you, Dr. Gabor Mate. It was such an honor to have you on the show some time back. Now let's turn to some recent emails from our listener community. First, we hear from Mark, who writes, Dear Dr. Dave, I continue to be grateful for the invaluable service you do for our helping community. Your recent commitment to us to keep your content available to all convinced me that I need to make my support for your good work more consistent. I've been in practice for a couple of years now, and I find your interviews keep me abreast of the authors, practitioners, and researchers on the cutting edge, helping me refine my orientation and improve my skills and effectiveness. I and my patients benefit every day from the approaches and techniques I have sought training in after hearing about them on your podcasts. I see your program as an essential part of my continuing education, helping me identify the direction to seek for more depth. I know of no other source for such a consistently high-quality and diverse scan of the profession, gratefully, and that's from Mark in Columbus, Ohio. Well, Mark, thank you so much for those words of high praise. I can't tell you how much they mean to me. I'm really glad to serve that function for you and other professionals out there. And here's one more, this one from Andrew, who writes, Good evening, Dr. Dave. I discovered Shrink Wrap Radio about a month ago, completely by accident while I was searching for psychology podcasts, after I ran out of Star Talk podcasts to listen to, and I've been completely hooked. You have a subscriber for life. Yay. I have told some of my classmates about it and hope they have already subscribed to it. I thoroughly enjoy your interviews and the wide variety of topics that you cover. They are a wonderful addition to my current studies, and I especially enjoy the more humanistic feel I get both from you and from your interviewees and their topics. Unfortunately, I'm not getting that type of feel in my current studies. I'm in my third year of my PsyD in a clinical psychology program in Minnesota and have a long commute to campus. So it's nice to have you and your interviewees as my companions on those treks. I'm interested in humanistic psychology, existential psychology, and Jungian analysis, in no small part due to your Jungian interviewees. I'm currently on episode number 364, Exploring the Wild Feminine with Marilyn Steele, PhD. I'm wondering something. I'm listening to your podcast through my iPhone, and when I first started listening, I was unable to start at the beginning. I started listening to number 328. Is there a way to access the previous podcast through this app? If not, no worries. I really enjoy what you do and wanted to do more to thank you other than with my email. But given my current financial constraints, I won't be able to do so until I get the next bout of student loan money here in January, so I hope my heartfelt appreciation will suffice for now. Thank you for all that you do, and I'm excited to continue to listen and learn from you and your amazing guests. With warm regards and appreciation, and that's from Andrew. And Andrew, you know, that's really one of the main reasons I started doing this podcast, was to reach out to students such as yourself who were in various graduate programs and undergraduate programs where the full sweep of psychology really is not being attended to these days. I really wanted to present a broader, a more humanistic orientation. And so it appears that with you, I've really hit the target. And in terms of listening to the early podcasts, the iTunes store and also the app that's available for Shrink Wrap Radio, they only have about 75 or so of the most recent episodes. But you can get all of the episodes by going onto our site at shrinkwrapradio.com and clicking on the All Shows tab. And then you'll be able to scroll down through to all the way down to the very beginning. Capturing them and getting them on your mobile device is a little bit trickier. You can't sort of subscribe to a whole block of them, but you can download them one at a time, typically by clicking on the download button while you are holding down the control key. Okay, so I think that better wrap it up for today. You can send your emails to shrink@shrinkwrapradio.com. You can leave comments about individual shows in the comments area on the site. And you can leave voicemail on our message phone at 415-830-4014. And you can also leave voicemails using our iPhone/Android app, about which you can find full details in the apps tab on our site. Thanks again to Dr. Marty Klein for his lively discussion about what's happening these days on the sexual frontier. My next interview will be with Dr. Nima Gorbani, who is a professor of psychology at the University of Tehran, and he's also a psychotherapist. And we'll be discussing psychology and psychotherapy in Iran, as well as his extensive research on Islam, as well as mindfulness and many other topics. So until then, this is Dr. Dave saying, it's all in your mind.
You've been shrink-wrapped by Dr. Dave. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make you dangerous.